My name is Bob Whitaker. I am from Pontiac, South Carolina. I don't want to make you people jealous, but that's where I'm from. It was one of those little towns out in the sand hills that the nearest grocery store to us was 3 miles away. And don't get let me not be, get me started on Pontiac. I then went on and I got, I became a professor. I entered college when I was 16 years old. I wrote books. I was a senior staffer on Capitol Hill. I was a Reagan appointee. I worked for the Voice of America, and this is the kind of thing that people love to hear about. But I also had a different attitude toward education. If a man learns to be a expert car mechanic, he doesn't learn how to have a car mechanic's point of view of the world. He is a man from his local area with local attitudes, and you'd be kind of crazy if you'd think he was kind of crazy if a guy walked around and said, "I have a carpenter's worldview," or auto mechanic's point of view, because it's not to give you a point of view; it's to give you a skill. You can do something good, which people pay you for, and that's always been my attitude toward education. I got a terrific education, and I have used it the same way that an automobile mechanic uses his skills. It doesn't change who I am. When I say I am still an old redneck from Pontiac, South Carolina, it carries a meaning that a lot of people today really can't understand. Oh, Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina. He was the very famous as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, who conducted the famous Watergate hearings. And he would always say in a very deep southern accent, of course, when somebody says, "I have a southern accent," I always say, "We don't have an accent. You have an accent. You know, 60-80 million of us." So why somebody else can say we have an accent is beyond me. But old Sam, Howard Baker, senator from Tennessee, was Sam Ervin's ranking member on the Republican side. And Howard said to him one time, he asked him something, you know. Sam Ervin leaned back and he said what he always said. "Well, Howard, I'm just a country lawyer from North Carolina." And Howard Baker said, "Senator, you are a magna cum laude graduate of the Harvard Law School. You're not just a country lawyer from North Carolina." And old Sam leaned back and he smiled, or as we Southerners say, he grinned, and he said, "Yeah, Howard, but nobody's ever gonna know it." Now, I hope I'm not talking too low. I said, "Yeah, Howard, nobody's gonna know it." He was a North Carolinian, a real smart one. He had gotten his magna cum laude, like Jimmy Clinton, Billy Clinton, Bill Clinton, you know. He did everything else and also made A's. He was just a real smart guy from Arkansas until the day, you know, until this very day, that southern accent, that sort of Popeye naivety that uses that southern accent is just devastating. And people never get over it. I used my southern accent in Washington. And it disarms people, and you always need, if you're in a hardcore negotiation, you need to use whatever advantage you got. And the southern accent is just magic if you know how to use it in Washington. Because you get, all these people are deeply convinced that they're brilliant and you're a good guy, but you're not all that smart. There was a Jew named Bernard Baruch, who was from Camden, South Carolina. His father was the Deputy Surgeon General of the Confederate States of America. And his boss, I've forgotten his name, the attorney, the Surgeon General of the Confederacy, was also Jewish. And Bernard Baruch said the first time he ever ran in to anti-Semitism was the first day they moved to New York City. Judah P. Benjamin was senator from Louisiana, and he was the first cabinet member, Jewish cabinet member in America. But he was a southerner. And we were fighting Yankees, you see. And so Judah P. Benjamin didn't run into this anti-Semitism. So what I'm trying to get back to is there's sort of this southern frame of mind. I remember one time saying I very seldom agreed with Thurgood Marshall. But when he retired from the Supreme Court, and please excuse my language here, it is the language of a justice of the United States Supreme Court. The reporter said, well, now, Justice Marshall, now that you're retiring, what are you going to do? And Justice Marshall looked up at him like he was an idiot, and he said, I'm going to sit on my ass. He had just spent 50 years working his tail off, and he was going to give his tail a little rest. So this is sort of what I call porch talk, which is why that's the title of this program. It tends, to say the least, toward the politically incorrect. But the people I want to understand me are going to understand exactly what I'm talking about. When I was in Africa, the Africans would say to people after they met me, they'd say, he's very African. Now, there are white people raised who have lived their whole lives in Kenya, South Africa, and the Africans will say, this man is very African. Well, we live in a society where, oh, that means he loves you, or, you know, he's saying you understand him, or some one thing or another like that. No, all it means is that he thinks of you as a white man who's very African. An Englishman who's a colonial administrator and goes down there for a few years, he's very European. And I've heard many and many a person try to analyze what the Africans meant by this man is very African. Does it mean he likes him? Does it mean he hates him? Is it a compliment? No, as a porch talker, I have to remind people that in our age of public relations and stuff like that, sometimes a man just means what he says. And the African talked to me for a while, and he said, he is very African. This doesn't mean he likes me. The people who kill each other most in Africa are very African. The Hutsis and the other tribe I'm having trouble with, they slaughtered like probably a total of 1 million of each other. They didn't exactly love each other. But if they would say, each tribe would say, oh yeah, he's very African. I mean, love. Sometimes it is fondness. Dr. Leakey, he was a big anthropologist. He was born and raised in Kenya. And the Kenyans generally tend to love him, the black Kenyans. And they would say he's a white man, a black man with a white skin. On the other hand, the Afrikaners down in South America, down in South Africa, a lot of the general population of black Africa hates their guts. But they will still say, this man is very African. Well, from one southerner to another, somebody who's used to porch talk, you'll understand what I'm talking about. We're not, porch talk is not living in one of these diplomatic worlds where you're trying to read all the stuff and what the man said. What the man said was what the man said. Some of the women would say, Whitaker is very African. Well, it says something also about the background of southern black people. I think the reason, remember, I was the first American that most of these people, black or white, had ever seen. And we didn't exactly fit into the categories because they're Frenchmen and Britons who come over there to advise or to or they were administrators, and the Africans say they're very European. On the other hand, there are people like Leakey, the Afrikaners, who were born and raised in Africa. The Afrikaners will usually speak 3 or 4 African languages as a matter of course. You know how it is when kids play around with each other, they just pick up each other's languages. Well, since I was the first American they had met, they were kind of wondering, you know, what this particular species of animal, the American, how they struck people. And they were very interested in the idea that I was considered a very African. And Australians or Canadians or New Zealanders who go over there are certainly not called very African. And so I'm sure there are hundreds of or thousands of Africans, black and white, that think that Americans are very African. And I guess just as when we sit over here, we say Africans, we're talking about, we think of them as one solid block of people, don't have any differences between them, and they would probably think the same thing about Americans. But I am an American who was raised by and around blacks out in rural South Carolina. My nearest white neighbor around my age was a mile away, played with black kids. My first multicultural experience was when I was sent to an all-white segregated white school. Well, that's the first time that I really had some white playmates. I had a black woman raising me and so forth. You know the old story. But it might be of interest to black people to know that the influence that they had on me made me seem African to the Africans. In other words, if you ever wonder whether every trace of the African has been taken out of at least southern blacks by all these years of white education, speaking English, wearing American clothes and all that, there is still enough of the African whatever it is. I never really got sure what African meant, but so much that it rubbed off on me, and when I took it to Africa, they could tell that I had associated, or that somehow I had this African aura. And again, it doesn't mean they loved me. It just tells us something about ourselves. Now, that doesn't mean that American blacks are just Africans, because I have known many and many a black man who's gone to Europe, just like any other American, and would come back, and like me, he's been bitching all his life about the American political system and so forth, and how blacks are treated over here and all that. And he gets to Europe and listens to European attitudes, and he says, you know, I didn't know how American I was until I got over there. So the American blacks have their, they've been here longer than most white people. And they have their American, you know, as I say, you don't really discover it. I don't care what color you are. When you go to Europe, most of us discover how American we are. But the African side of it also came through. And the point I wanted to make to you was that in our society, we're talking porch talk here. Now, normally I would make some sort of little speech here about it shows the closeness of the Southerner to the African, or this, that, and the other. Well, all I'm saying is, first of all, the man in Africa who says this is an African white man, or he is making a statement. He's not making a sociological comment. He's making an observation. That's a very hard thing in our society for people to understand. Now, down here, the old guy like me, whether he's black or white, will be out on the porch. He'll be talking along, and I'm sure in Africa they made the same observation. They said he's a very African white man. Well, in our society, what the next question is supposed to be is, what are the sociological implications of the statement you've made? Or are you putting him into a higher category? Or are you putting him down? Or are you, then ensues the conversation we're all supposed to have. But in porch talk, what the old guy said was what the old guy said, about the only question you might ask, although the Africans seem to understand what they mean better than I do, when a man says that a white man is African. It's pretty well understood. I doubt that even the children ask their father, if in a black family, what they mean by that, and the whites are absolutely mystified by it. But there is such a thing in this world as just saying what you're thinking, porch talk. And you don't go into the sociological implications, and you don't say, you shouldn't have said that. Never heard that, only unless that we were using, you know, down the Bible Belt, we use some words we shouldn't have used. Of course, the women are going to tell us to straighten it out. We shouldn't have said that. Generally, we're just talking. I guess it could be called just talking. And we're saying what we think. And you don't understand in our world what an unusual thing porch talk is. I think we could use a lot more of it myself. But this idea of just making observations. I wrote a book called Why Johnny Can't Thank America's Professor Priesthood. And of course, everybody says, well, Bob, yes, this is good, but it's highly intellectual stuff, and nobody's going to understand it. Well, I'm a writer. If you don't understand what I say, I failed. You haven't failed, I failed. That's one of the big things, intellectuals today, they say. Well, if you don't understand it, that's your fault. That just shows what level you're on. My feeling is, if I'm like, well, my grandfather was a circuit rider, so if you're not understood, you're not doing your job. And there was a black lady here who's one of the guards at this condo here. And she got a hold of my book. I took it down to her. And she read it from kiver to kiver. It's not that long a book. And she kept saying, I am your greatest fan. I mean, she wanted to make that very clear. Well, come on now. Everybody would say, that book of yours, Bob, has a number. I mean, it goes all the way through about how I'm worried about preserving the white race. How on earth could a black woman like it? Well, there was a lot more in that book than just preserving the white race or the fact that I feel like we're being crowded out of existence. Yeah, a lot of it is about how stupid this college degree system is. I keep saying you need to outgrow your college education. This lady has spent her whole life under this college graduate superstition. But there's a lot more to it. She's got children. They're being put through the things that I'm complaining about here. There's a bunch of stuff in there. The only thing the average liberal or the average respectable conservative would notice was the sociological implication of the book. But a lot of it is just plain talk. And so I said, but Bob, in that book you have all this about preserving the white race. Well, I'm a white man. Now, to everybody else, that suppose if you're a leader, a black leader or a white leader or something, that's supposed to be a big deal. Her attitude was, he's a white man. He's worried about white people. Okay, so what comes next? But as I say, she kept saying she was my best fan. She just loved the book. Now, one thing she wouldn't tell me, you're talking about making minorities feel good, what she was almost saying was, she didn't expect, now this sounds like a joke, but it's true, she didn't expect a person with all my background, and all my education, and all my books, to still make perfectly common Pontiac, South Carolina logical sense. And I think that's what impressed her most of all. I was just talking to her. Like I say, porch talk. And if I said some things that offended her, she was a lot less impressed by that. I really didn't say anything that was particularly offensive. But, boy, all of the professional protectors of the black race. They came down on that book like a freight train. I mean, I suppose it was a horrible set of insults. That's about all they noticed about it. There's a lot more in there. But I'm just sort of demonstrating the fact that a lot of people, I think, in the United States are hungry for somebody to just say some stuff. Cut the crap. It's like the N-word. You know, when I was coming up, there were a lot worse words than the N-word. And they were generally invented by black people talking about each other. You see, among whites down there, you know, most people, I like to say we have the best people and the worst people there are in the South. And we have white trash. And let me tell you, gang, that is about the lowest category of humanity there is. They're really nasty. And the blacks would call their equivalent of white trash coons. Now, when you call somebody white trash, you're a white man, or you are a black man, or a black man, you call somebody a coon, you better be ready to defend yourself, because it was a nasty thing to say. So, the N-word was usually the reason a lot of people used it, because it's easier. I remember I used to, this old Deacon, we called him Deacon, worked on a brick plant. He weighed about 120 pounds, and he was not a colored man. He was a black man down there. I saw more really black men in South Carolina, percentage-wise, than I did in Africa. There are some of them up in the Congo, and but in South Carolina, we have people that are really, I mean, coal black. And old Dick was one of them, and we called him Deacon because he had his own little church, and we gave him a bell for his church. But when Deacon wasn't preaching, he was sort of like St. Peter and St. Paul. Everybody talks about, everybody pays the clergy these days. Well, St. Paul was known as the tent maker. St. Peter was known as a big, strong fisherman. He made his own living. And old Deacon, so I've got a little, maybe my Bible Belt background, I've got a little preference for the preachers who are inspired by God and who work for their own living. And he'd preach, we'd be pushing the transfer on the brick plant. This is a little hard to explain, but it was, back then a brick plant was horribly heavy work. And that scoundrel would work me and my brother to death. This huge thing that had to be pushed. And he'd be preaching every inch of the way. And a lot of times he'd say negus because it's just easier for us down south. The word Negro, which was popular then, if you're a Southerner, you say Negro. It sounds like you're groveling on the ground, because if you just listen to the way I talk, my I don't use hard language, and Negro is very hard for a Southerner to pronounce. Sometimes we'd say Negra, or colored people. That kind of thing. But the point I'm making, and the hard N-word is an insult, and it would be in the South too, because we don't use hard letters. The R at the end, we wouldn't use the hard R. That's if you're going out of your way to be insulting. Well, decent white people don't do that. But all this would go right by the average professional in relations, social relations, and all that stuff. So this is just porch talk. This is saying, it's an old guy saying how things were and how he thinks things are. And if you listen to an old guy talk, this is a Southern superstition. If you listen to an old guy talk, he'll try to be entertaining to you. Or the kids will sneak out. And if you listen to him close, you'll pick up some good stuff. You'll pick up a lot of stuff about when he was a kid, he used to walk 20 miles in the snow. All that stuff. You're going to hear that. It's like most people, 99% of what everybody says is worthless. But the old guy has the 1%, and when he dies, you're going to get the 1%. And young people are wiser about that. They listen to the guy who just talks. And the problem with the highly educated, now I'm highly educated, but I grew out of it. But the highly educated person who talks says, you might as well just read your school books. He's not telling you anything. That old guy that's worked all his life, has been doing actual things all his life, and hasn't gotten some sort of philosophy or something and just telling you how things are. He's got something to teach you. And that's what I'm trying. I would like to do. I'd like to just not teach you. What I like to do is just talk. And it's up to you to sift out what's good and what's bad. But I was there a long time ago. I have a particular point of view. The other thing you don't do in porch talk is you don't say, "Shall I make this man's ideas, my philosophy of life," like some kind of book. He's got something to say. What you think about it is your business. And that's what sometimes I have a lot of trouble with young people. They say, "Well, you said so-and-so, and I went by it, and whether it worked," and I keep telling them, I'm not giving you a cookbook. I'm telling you some stuff I know. When I'm arguing, I got some arguments that are good. They work. Then I've got some arguments that made me look like a damn fool. There's no reason for you to look like a fool, so don't make the same mistake. But if you go to your professor, or you go to your intellectual, or these days, if you go to Dr. Phil, well, maybe I'm being unfair to him, but you always expect to be given some kind of cookbook to life. This is the way you live your life, son. There's nothing wrong with an old man saying, "This is the way you live your life, son," or "This is the way you handle women." Boy, is that ever hopeless. Or something like that. And you've got advice columns. These people are supposed to be real experts. The nice thing about porch talk is you just listen. Some of it's entertaining. Most of it's drivel. But there's really no substitute for the old porch talk. That's why Southerners make such good writers. Because we're used to talking. We don't expect you to believe every word we say. And that's what I want to give you. You take what you want. I hope to heaven that you consider it at least entertaining. I want to make you laugh some. My kind of humor is a little odd. Actually, it's a little British. My British background. I was talking to some Britishers the other day. The British have a way. I'm bad at grabbing up examples. But they have a way of saying something that is so true, it's funny. It's exactly what you were thinking. But it's also not very deep or philosophical. It's just the truth. And sometimes the truth, just stating the truth, can be very amusing because everybody else is running around theorizing and being deadly serious and all that stuff. And then some guy comes along with a real insight. And it's short, it's punchy, and it's funny. That's where a lot of the porch talk humor comes from. Somebody will just explain the world to you. Explain something that all these philosophers have just written 14,000 or 140,000 words about. And that's educational in itself. Now, I know I'm preaching to the converted for most Southerners, but I also think I am reminding you, if you're black or white, that you've been through porch talk. And porch talk is a lot smarter in many, many ways than university talk. And I hope, first of all, that you will enjoy what I say. I'm going to start. This is just my introduction. I'll do a couple of these, and then I'll start taking calls and let people raise hell with me or whatever they feel like. But, Lord, I wish we could get back to some old-fashioned porch talk. And I hope to see you next program, if I'm not banned off the air tomorrow. I appreciate the people of Memphis giving me a chance to do some porch talking to the people around Tennessee and Western Kentucky and Mississippi, thank God for, Alabama, Upper Louisiana, Missouri, and hope you'll listen in again. This is Bob Whitaker. See you later.